Can we rely on nuclear to give us clean, reliable, and affordable power? This is The Interchange Recharged, a Wood Mackenzie production. I'm David Bandmiller. Is it a crucial piece of the energy transition puzzle, or do the high costs and untested technology at scale make it unfeasible? SMRs, or small modular reactors, have the potential to address some of the concerns, like waste management and safety. We get firm baseload power from nuclear without greenhouse gas emissions, but there are regulatory and financial barriers standing in the way to mass adoption. At the end of 2023, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission announced proposed revisions to its regulations around emergency programs for new advanced reactors. It was an example of the much-needed updating to regulatory frameworks in the industry as the new technology moves rapidly forward. Ted Norhaus is the co-founder of the Breakthrough Institute, a research center in Berkeley, California that promotes technological solutions to environmental problems. He says that the potential for nuclear is there, but despite the NRC's recent focus on regulatory updates, regulations are still holding development back. On the show today, can we rely on nuclear to give us a clean, reliable, and affordable power? What are the changes in regulations and finance that could help deliver it? And what does the current tech look like? Let's find out. Ted, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So can you give us a little overview of the Breakthrough Institute, your guys' mission, what you're focused on?
So we are a research center, think tank. We're based in the Bay Area in California, actually in Berkeley, and we focus on technological solutions to environmental problems. And sort of unlike a lot of the sort of environmental movement, the climate movement, we're very pro-growth, pro-development, pro-technology, and think that those things are actually the key to solving the world's environmental problems.
And what type of technologies are you kind of focused on right now? And where do you see the biggest possibility for impact?
Well, you know, if you think about climate, which is the thing that everybody sort of focuses on, we're pretty all of the above, whether it's renewable energy, nuclear, carbon capture. Clean is good, but clean also needs to be cheap. It needs to be reliable, and it needs to sort of serve a variety of needs and ways that energy works in the economy. But then one of the things that we're particularly focused on and have long been very focused on is the role of nuclear energy. So we were really one of the first sort of reasonably well-known environmental organizations to come out and say, hey, nuclear energy is a really important environmental and climate technology. We need it. We're not going to run the entire global economy on variable sources of renewable energy like wind and solar. We're going to need nuclear, which is this sort of remarkable, energy-dense, low-carbon technology that actually has a, you know, long-standing, proven capability to both displace fossil fuels and to power modern industrial economies kind of almost entirely, or at least almost entirely in terms of their electrical needs, and can also do a bunch of other things that we need to do if you're really serious about getting emissions down.
Yeah, you know, I've said before on this podcast, I'm a fan of nuclear. Some of the challenges that we obviously have are just the stigma that goes with it. But I think some of the technology that has evolved over the years has really played a role in safety, just all the environmental concerns. But then you also have the cost. And so you had mentioned making sure that it's clean, cost effective, and so the long lead time with some of these. What are some of the developments that you've seen that have really started to help with the cost and the lead time on getting some of these reactors built?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to kind of pull that apart a little bit because, you know, once upon a time, we were able to actually build these things fast and cheap. So if you look at the first wave of US reactors up through about the mid-1970s, if you look at France, Sweden, even if you look at South Korea or China today, we know that you can build a lot of nuclear reactors. You can build them fast, you can build them cheap. And if you look at kind of all of that fleet all over the world, they still provide some of the cheapest electricity that you can get anywhere, kind of like almost nothing except for like totally unconstrained fossil fuels without emissions controls kind of remotely compares to it. So we know that we can do nuclear cheaply and we know we can do it quickly. We've done it in the past, but you know, there's a couple of things you have to keep in mind when you look at that past and then when you think about what it would take to do that again today. The first is that those were all cases, except for arguably in the US, where all of that nuclear was sort of built by pretty centralized economies, state-led nuclear developers or companies that were then building nuclear for sort of state-run, pretty centralized national electrical grids. And that's still basically what you see in China, which is building more nuclear than any place else. And even in the US, we were doing it in the old era of kind of vertically integrated, regulated monopoly utilities. And in the US, we've deregulated a huge amount of the electrical sector, and those institutional arrangements don't exist anymore. And the second thing is that a generation ago, we decided that nuclear was this really dangerous, unsafe technology that needed to be sort of radically regulated in a way that no other energy technology is regulated. And the truth is, it is not that. Nuclear has been, continues to be the safest energy technology that humans have ever invented. And that's not hyperbole. If you just go look at study after study after study that looks at like every body count you can associate with nuclear over like 70 years of commercial operation divided by the amount of energy it is produced, it outperforms everything, including wind and solar. So it's been an extremely safe technology. It was safe in the 60s and 70s. It's extremely safe now. So what are we regulating? What is it? And what historically has it taken to build it? You know, there's two things you have to do. One, you have to decide you want to build it. Historically, you had to do that through sort of centralized state-led companies and utilities. And you have to decide that, you know, you're going to take a rational approach to radiological health risks, which we really don't do most places. But then the third thing is, in the US, a lot of other places, these sort of centralized grid, monopoly, utility, state-led, that doesn't exist anymore. And so when you look at the technological developments and you look at it on the business side, what we're now seeing, there are a bunch of companies with really innovative, interesting, sort of smaller modular designs of a variety of different technological characteristics that are being developed. Companies are trying to license them right now. For a variety of reasons, they're sort of better suited for a liberalized, deregulated electricity market. They're smaller. In theory, you should be able to finance them with public finance. You should be able to sort of manufacture them entirely off-site in factories, so you start to get technological learning. But we have a regulatory framework that is both sort of radically, irrationally conservative about radiological health risk, and it's also entirely designed to license large, conventional light water reactors and is totally inflexible in terms of sort of dealing with these new technologies, much smaller reactors that have very different characteristics. So if you want those technologies to get deployed and commercialized, you're going to have to significantly change the regulatory environment in which they're being licensed and regulated. And there's a big battle to do that right now in the US around the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And that's going to happen all over the world if you're going to kind of see this new generation of nuclear reactors that really kind of are not your grandfather's large light water reactor.
Do you think that those discussions are making progress right now? I mean, given that we're coming off of COP28 and there's a big focus on the energy transition globally, there's a lot of political pressure. So do you think that those discussions and the push on the NRC to help revamp those regulatory guidelines that they have to help alleviate some of them to get these reactors in there, is that showing?
We're going to find out, I think, in the next couple of months. So yeah, as a lot of people know, many of your listeners may know, John Kerry goes to Dubai to COP28 and, you know, with 22 other countries, announces this very grand plan to triple nuclear generation capacity between today and 2050, which would take nuclear from about 10% of global electricity today to a third. And if you actually really did that in the right way, which is that one of the things that nuclear really can do that's sort of difficult to do otherwise with clean energy is it can replace large coal plants. But we're a long way from being able to do that, you know, unless you're just counting on like China and a couple of other places to build all those nuclear plants in China and a few other places, it's not going to happen without pretty significant change at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a bunch of other places. So right now, you know, back in 2019, the U.S. Congress passes a law called the Nuclear Energy Innovation and Modernization Act. And it says there's this new generation of nuclear technologies, advanced reactors, they're not like the old reactors, and the NRC needs to be ready to license these reactors. And you don't have the right regulatory frameworks right now to do that. You need to do this. So that's 2019. We're now 2023, 4 years later. And, you know, one of the problems with a lot of these kind of old sort of regulatory institutions from like the 70s is they're pretty hidebound and sclerotic. And they're big bureaucracies. People have been there forever. They understand how to do one thing, and they really don't like to do things in a different way. It just requires you to change your routines and your practices. So the NRC staff takes like 4 years to develop this new framework, and they sort of unveil it, you know, with great anticipation. And basically what they did is they just took the old frameworks for large light water reactors, and they knocked the corners off them a little bit and said, ta-da, here it is. Here's our new framework. Looks pretty much just like the old framework. And kind of like literally everybody, Congress, the nuclear industry, NGOs like the Breakthrough Institute, national laboratories all go, that is not going to work. One of the nuclear industry groups does a sort of anonymized survey of advanced nuclear developers and says, given how this current rule is being proposed, would you use it to license your reactors? And they all go, no, it would just be better to go use these old rules designed for large light water reactors than to try to use this new rule that actually, for a variety of reasons, the NRC staff makes even more complicated. So that's a non-starter, and it's been sitting at the commission for like 9 months now. And, you know, there's normally five commissioners on the commission. Because it's a Democratic president right now, it's three Democrats and two Republicans. One of the Democrats was renominated, who has been a longtime anti-nuclear obstructionist, old school. And Democrats have come a long way over the last decade from sort of being kind of like nuclear shall not be spoken of and it's dangerous and we don't want it, to now being like, hey, climate change, it's an emergency and nuclear is a key technology and we need it. And that's why John Kerry goes to COP28 and kind of brokers this pledge from everyone to build a lot more nuclear. But when it comes to like actually fixing the regulatory framework, a lot of Democrats are still not so sure about that. So we, among others, but really kind of led the effort to stop Barron's confirmation. This was this fifth Democratic commissioner named Jeff Barron on the commission. We're just sort of like, if Democrats are serious about nuclear and about advanced nuclear energy and a future for this technology, you can't put this guy back on the commission. And to their credit, a number of Democratic senators who were like, yep, we need that nuclear, just said, nope, not going to do it. Or at least have not been willing to commit to vote for him. So that's been stopped. So it's a 2-2 kind of breakdown on the commission right now. Two of the commissioners, the two Republicans, have actually already voted on this proposal and have basically kind of put out fairly significant changes that they say would need to be made in order to approve it. And so right now, kind of everyone is waiting on the two remaining Democratic commissioners, including the chairman, to vote. So at some point in the next couple of months, they're going to cast their votes, and we're going to kind of see whether this commission is really ready to lead on this issue, or it's just sort of too polarized and divided to really take action. And I think at that point, my view is that it's not just this particular rule. It's just really about whether we have the leadership at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that would be necessary to kind of create a rational, safe, but efficient licensing framework so that all of this new innovation, all of this new sort of entrepreneurial, technological innovation that is kind of ready to go and kind of test itself in the market can actually get through a regulatory process in a way that what comes out the other end is something that anyone would ever want to build or buy.
How much input did the industry have in the development of those guidelines? I mean, I know that you said it took about 4 years for a revamp to come out that looked largely the same. Have they had any input?
So we, the industry, were deeply involved in all the public meetings, providing extensive regulatory comment to the commission staff, which was just basically ignored. And the staff said, thank you very much, but we know what we're doing and we know how to do this. And we're going to do it the same way we've been doing it for 40 years with large light water reactors, which, of course, until, you know, there's sort of two plants that just came online just this year in Georgia, very over budget and massively delayed. Those are the first two new reactor designs with one design, but that's the first new reactor design that the NRC has ever licensed in its entire history, going back to 1975, that actually went into operation and started generating electricity. So the NRC staff perspective is nothing's broken here, nothing needs to be fixed. And obviously, if that's your view, then we should just forget about new nuclear, certainly in this country, anytime soon, because no one is lining up to build more of those large AP1000 reactors they just built in Georgia, at least not under the current regulatory environment. It's just not going to happen. And we got like 50 years of evidence to suggest that it's not going to happen.
It's an exciting time for solar. Advancements in tech, policy support, investment, and the decentralization of solar promise a bright future for the industry. New materials are increasing efficiency, and AI is helping to better predict supply and demand. Tax credits are driving investment, and large projects across many U.S. states are grabbing headlines. On The Interchange, we dive deep into the technology and financing that's driving solar growth. We've been joined by industry leaders and experts on the show over the past couple years, and we're back this year to do it again. We'll be in San Francisco on the 12th and 13th of June at Wood Mackenzie's Solar and Energy Storage Summit. As always, I'll be bringing you the debates, conversations, and insight from the industry's leading event right here on the podcast. To secure your ticket, visit woodmac.com/events and subscribe to The Interchange so you don't miss the special episodes coming in June. Look forward to seeing you there.
So, I mean, look, with the heightened focus on the environment and energy security, hopefully we're at a time now where some pressure can be put on the NRC to adjust these regulatory guidelines they have, and we can accelerate the building of these reactors. Because the other thing that I wanted to talk about is obviously this requires a tremendous amount of investment. And I think some of the numbers that your team had come up with is that to start with this, to get to where we need to be from a nuclear power standpoint with the energy transition is about $150 to $220 billion by 2035 to be invested, which grows by 2050 to, you know, somewhere over $1 trillion. That's a big amount of money. I mean, the energy transition in general is a tremendous amount of investment needed. How do you think we can incentivize that level of investment, and where do you think those monies are going to come from?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, the first is, like, those numbers you just cited is a study we did where we basically kind of go, like, you know, if you're going to go to sort of net zero in 2050 and you have sort of first of a kind reactors available in 2030, how much of it do you build? How much does the market want? Now, that's predicated on the idea that we are actually going to go to net zero or something close to it over that time. And it's predicated on the idea that these technologies are licensed and available. We looked at a range of potential costs for those first reactors. And in a kind of crazy Byzantine impossible regulatory environment, one of the problems is that it's really difficult to really know what these first reactors are going to cost because it's so hard to get them licensed and you don't know how the regulator is going to deal with it through the licensing process. And so you don't know what you're going to get, you know, what you're going to have to do to get through the licensing in terms of changing your design, that kind of thing. So the first thing on that number is you got to have the reactors available. And the second thing is that you got to want to build a low carbon electricity system. But if you have those two things, what we find, and we don't assume that reactors get cheaper, we just assumed some variable rates of technological learning. And then we, what's called, endogenize that in the sort of modeling. So nuclear doesn't get cheaper unless someone buys it and you build more of it and you get better. So this is not kind of just assuming it happens. This kind of goes like at the starting point of whatever those first reactors cost, someone has to decide they want to buy them. I think the other thing that's not really fully factored into our analysis, and that is a real challenge, I think, in a lot of electricity markets, is that the low carbon benefit of nuclear is still not really valued. You know, we throw very kind of direct subsidies at wind and solar, and nuclear generally doesn't get those, or certainly hasn't in the past. And the other thing is that we don't really value the sort of firm generation that it provides, the fact that it can provide electricity all the time. You don't have to have a gas plant sitting in the background or a massive battery that in a lot of cases doesn't actually exist right now in the alternative to kind of basically provide electricity when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. So your question is, well, what would it happen and where does that money come from? Well, a lot of it comes from the private sector if you have reasonably economically viable nuclear technology. Because, you know, it does all the things you want. It provides low carbon electricity. It provides it very reliably. It provides it all the time. It can firm up the grid. It can actually follow a lot of the variability in the renewable energy that you have on the grid. So all of that is extremely valuable to the electrical sector. But to get there, you not only need to fix the regulatory situation, you know, there's so much uncertainty right now. And because we have hardly built any reactors for 30, 40 years, the supply chains aren't there. The skilled workforce, the management and construction and manufacturing expertise, it's all gone because we let it atrophy and you have to rebuild all of that. So, you know, I think the reality is that if the U.S. Congress is really serious about nuclear, they're going to have to make some advanced market commitments. And not to say like, okay, we'll give you a little bit of money and we'll share some costs for you to build a demonstration reactor or just like a one-off first of a kind thing. And then we'll all kind of look at it. And of course, it's going to be like over budget and it's going to take longer than people think it's going to take because you've not done it before. But you need to really say like, okay, you know, we'll go pay for 10 of those. Enough that you can kind of get your supply chain set up. If you're manufacturing in a factory, you can actually kind of build a factory. So to set up enough of a production process that you can kind of do it in an efficient way, you can get some learning, you can do it once, go like, okay, now we can understand how we can do that more. But, you know, it's like anything else, whether it's a gas or a wind turbine or automobile chassis or anything else, you got to kind of do it a few times to figure out how to do it well and how to do it cost effectively. And you got to be able to have enough of a commitment up front that, you know, you can kind of have some leverage with suppliers and things like that. So my view is the three things. You have to have the regulatory reform. You know, one way or another, we just need to value the benefit of low carbon firm generation in the electrical grid. And we need to make some initial commitments that are significantly beyond what Congress and the federal government has been willing to make to date. Enough that investors and companies and customers all have enough certainty to be like, okay, we're going to kind of go build 10 of these things and see where we end up. And one of the advantages, because so many of them are smaller, is that the cost is not like saying, okay, we're going to go build 10 1 gigawatt large conventional reactors. Some cases, like the Bill Gates reactor that they're trying to build, the first one in Wyoming, I think is about 300 megawatts. And that's pretty large for advanced reactors. You get to others, you know, the NuScale, which was that first small modular reactor, which unfortunately had to cancel its first contract. That's a 77 megawatt reactor. There's others that go down to like 15 megawatts. So building 20, 15 megawatt reactors, even if per unit they cost more than 1 gigawatt reactor, the amount of money that you need to put on the table to get there is actually significantly less.
Yeah, and that feeds into an interesting chart that you had in that same analysis that showed the levelized cost of energy coming down significantly after a pretty nice bump in the investment side. And so the cost comes down pretty significantly after a certain amount of investment. So to your point about building 10, getting another belt, that, you know, they're going to be over budget and longer than expected. But then as you get that, the economies of scale kind of kick in, and then you really start seeing that benefit.
Yeah, and I think that's the point. And it's not like this is unique to nuclear. This is true for just about any new technology. But today, insofar as we like really have committed to it in recent years and decades, we do it in the most half-assed possible way and then kind of be like, we'll provide a little bit of support to kind of build one And then we look at it and we're going, oh my God, it's so expensive. This is not a recipe for success. And if you want this technology, you're just going to have to make some commitments and take some risk, you know, and that risk is, I think, appropriately taken by the public sector, because having this technology available is a public good. But I don't think it should be or is necessarily an open-ended commitment. You know, you got to be like, you know, we're going to let competition in the market decide this to some degree, but we're going to set this up so that three or four of these companies with smaller reactors can get to market and can build a bunch of them. And we're going to kind of share in the cost of getting to that point. And then we'll see where we are. And my view gets just supported even at a level of first principles is that just the basic characteristics of nuclear energy should be the cheapest source of energy we have. And that's just because it has extraordinary energy density. Nuclear fuel is the densest fuel source and energy source that we have. For every unit, pound, kilogram, however you want to measure it, there's just a lot more energy there. And you put it into a reactor and it produces a lot more energy. So for that reason, the cost of the fuel compared with fossil fuels is much, much, much lower. Uranium mining and processing, whatever, there's costs there. But then when you put it in a reactor, it creates an enormous amount of electricity over a long period of time. So as a share of every kilowatt of electricity you generate, it's an extraordinarily low cost. And similarly, because of that energy density, nuclear, large or small, also has the lowest material footprint of any other technology. In other words, per unit of energy it generates, there is less steel, less cement, fewer critical minerals, fewer costly inputs in the kind of cost basis of it. So we have this technology that has very little fuel cost and very little material input cost per amount of electricity or energy out, useful electricity and energy that it produces for an electrical grid or whatever. So that should mean that it should be the cheapest energy source we have, but of course it's not. And so then you have to go, well, why is that? And that kind of brings you back to, in particular, a sort of regulatory framework that is sort of predicated on a misguided, in a lot of cases, just totally outdated view of radiological health risk that results in us making these things incredibly expensive instead of incredibly cheap. So if you want cheap, clean energy, which will be extremely safe, and these new advanced reactors actually, for a variety of reasons, historically, light water reactors, the conventional technology has actually been extremely safe. Most of the advanced technologies are literally an order of magnitude and will be an order of magnitude safe. They're safer just for sort of basic reasons in terms of how the fuels work and how the cooling systems work. So it will be extremely safe. And so if we want really safe, clean, cheap energy, we can have it, but we have to decide we want it.
And that same analysis, and to your point, if we truly want to get to net zero by 2050, here's what it looks like and here's what has to happen, is there was a chart that was pretty aggressive on all forms of renewable energy. It had coal being completely phased out, I think, by 2030, and then aggressive growth targets for both solar, wind, as well as nuclear. So it was pretty eye-popping, and then that's obviously where the investment dollars and the need for that come from.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, and this is not just our analysis, kind of every analysis that looks at it, if you kind of go like, what's the least cost, cheapest way to get to a sort of zero emissions grid, it has a lot of nuclear in it. It doesn't have to be all nuclear, and you can still do a lot of wind and solar, but having nuclear in that mix brings the cost down massively because you don't have to totally overbuild and build this sort of Rube Goldberg-esque electrical system to sort of move electricity across continental distances and have massive batteries, you know, in addition to all the batteries that are going to go in the EVs that are supposedly going to take over everything. We're going to have these massive batteries that are going to sort of store electricity for weeks or months. And it's a crazy, crazy system if you try to do it all this way. And it's so much cheaper, even with 30, 40% of that nuclear, because that nuclear's there, it's all the time. The new technologies, much more so than the old existing ones, can ramp up and down. So when you have a lot of solar, you can actually ramp that down. You can put it into like a molten salt storage system for a couple of hours and then ramp it back up. And there's a bunch of different ways this works. that will actually be quite sort of well aligned with a system that also has a lot of variable generation in it. But if you don't have that, the whole thing gets much harder.
So you have a campaign right now, the Build Nuclear Now campaign, and I'm sure a lot of the points we've already touched on during our discussion and some of the goals that you're trying to achieve, but what are some of the things that you're doing along the lines of that campaign to help drive this initiative?
Yeah, Build Nuclear Now is a campaign we launched, but we've got a number of partners. And one of the really interesting things right now that, you know, was not the case even like 5-6 years ago is that there's a real grassroots pro-nuclear movement now. There are people all over the country, and there's little grassroots groups in lots of states that are like, we want nuclear here. You know, a lot of these states back in the 70s or 80s or whatever passed like moratoriums on new nuclear energy in those states. And a lot of these groups are working to lift those moratoriums. They're working to kind of get states to sort of start really thinking seriously about nuclear. And they're also working with us to kind of get the federal regulatory system fixed so that we can actually kind of build and commercialize this new generation. So it's called Build Nuclear Now, and it's just buildnuclearnow.org. And, you know, it's a sort of central repository for just knowing what's happening politically at the NRC, places like that. You can sign up to get updates and action alerts. You can write your senators and tell them not to vote for Jeff Barron's confirmation in the Senate. There's a big effort after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Everyone sort of wakes up and goes, wait a minute, we're getting like 40-50% of our reactor fuel from Russia. And all of the ability to actually enrich fuels to a slightly higher level, which is what these advanced reactors need. We're counting on Russia to do it, and that's not going to happen. So there's now an effort in Congress to fund and restart. The U.S. historically had the ability to process, manufacture, and enrich nuclear fuels, and we just let it atrophy like everything else. We kind of stopped doing it in the early 90s, and we don't really have any domestic capacity. So there's an effort to restart that. And again, there'll be opportunities there to let your members of Congress know that they should support that. So I think the most important thing and the thing that's really changed a lot of the conversation about nuclear is that people like us, both at the federal level, but also in the states, who are now like showing up as advocates for nuclear energy. And here in California, where I am, you know, we just had a big fight around keeping the Diablo Canyon plant open, which is planned to close. And one of the things that was really, really interesting is historically, if you went to like a public meeting from the Public Utilities Commission or the California Energy Commission or whatever about keeping a plant like Diablo open, you know, you'd look out and like everybody in the room would be an anti-nuclear activist. And it totally flipped. And this time around, over the last couple of years, whenever there have been public meetings, it's mostly been pro-nuclear activists. And this is not some industry-funded thing. This is just people who come out of the woodwork because they really care about nuclear and they know we need it and they care about climate change. And so, you know, a lot of the old school anti-nuclear groups would go to these things and they were shocked because they'd go to these meetings and there'd be 50 or 70 people there to kind of speak on behalf of nuclear and in favor of nuclear and in favor of keeping the Diablo Canyon plant open. And there'd be like four anti-nuclear activists who'd been to every meeting for the last 50 years kind of reading off their talking points about why it was unsafe and like it was going to be the end of human civilization if there was an accident at Diablo Canyon, which is just sort of like, you know, total fear-mongering. It's just literally not true. So Build Nuclear Now is really a hub for people to kind of get connected, learn more about what's happening, find out how they can get involved. And I really encourage your listeners who support nuclear energy to go there, sign up, and get involved in the effort to really change the future of nuclear.
Well, Ted, I've really appreciated the discussion. I'm looking forward to see how everything evolves over the coming months with the NRC and the regulatory framework, as well as some of the promises and results that come out of COP28 and what actions actually are taken as a result. So really appreciate you coming on the show, and thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, David, and happy to do it.
The Interchange is a Wood Mackenzie production. We'll be releasing the show every second Tuesday. So mark your diaries and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. I'm David Bandmiller. It's been a pleasure joining you. See you next time.